ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, and welcome to Rear Vision. I'm Ros Blewett. Today, innovation, its power and its past.
Innovation is like building a pyramid. Everything rests on what came below.
This world of AI, it's moving so quickly, we need to make sure that we have a capability that can adapt.
It's the biggest gold rush we have seen possibly in the history of capitalism.
Innovation creates global power.
Australia has had its innovation moments. The flight data recorder, the Hills Hoist, and of course Wi-Fi. But as funding for research and development tightens, alarm bells are ringing. Because beyond our shores, and frankly beyond our dreams, innovation is accelerating at an astonishing rate. Today on Rear Vision, we take a step back from the gadget, the app, and the headline grab, and look at the big picture. Economic historians agree the past 250 years have seen an unprecedented surge in innovation. Not a steady hum, but six great waves. Each wave driven by a breakthrough so powerful it reshapes society. And each one is eventually swept away by the next. They call it creative destruction. We're now living through the sixth wave. But to understand where we've been and where we're heading, we need to go back to where it all began. England in the 1750s. A feudal world of guilds and cottages, peasants spinning and weaving cloth by hand for the lord of the manor. A system that had endured for centuries, about to be creatively destroyed. Enter James Hargreaves. His invention, the spinning jenny, allowing multiple threads to be spun at once. And with that simple, radical leap, the first wave began.
Suddenly, it became 200 times cheaper to make cloth with the spinning jennies driven by steam engines. So imagine that, going from people weaving by hand, and then suddenly 200 times as much could be made.
Per Aspen Stocknes is co-director of the BI Centre for Sustainability and Energy in Oslo.
Based on spinning and weaving, there was a rapid growth of factories in the UK. That sent ripples through the world as it escalated, and also, of course, through the UK cities. The new owners, the factory owners, became rich and powerful and was able to start to dismantle the feudal system.
It takes place in Britain, partly because of proximity of coal mines to industrial centres, partly because Britain had strong legal institutions that made it easy to set up a company and file a patent, and partly because it had a strong artisan tradition.
Andrew Lee is author of The Shortest History of Innovation.
A lot of innovation emerges serendipitously and because of the circumstances that are around. It's often not a single eureka moment, but a development which emerges out of a lot of hard work. You've got James Watt's steam engine, you've got the spinning jenny, you've got a huge revolution in machine tools technologies that takes place in the 1700s.
There was a lot of tearing of hair and gnashing of teeth.
Robert Friedel is Professor Emeritus in the Department of History at the University of Maryland.
But the products of the technology, the yarn, the cloth, all of that was made much, much cheaper, very, very competitive with the rest of the world. Typically, workers would find other employment, industry would increase, industry would diversify, so that once the disruptions have worked their way through society, the standard of living was higher across the board.
Gradually, UK exported more and more and became a colonial power based on that enormous growth of the largest weaving and spinning companies. So that's how incredible the start was. And they changed the cityscape of UK. So people moved to the cities to get jobs, weaving and spinning. The mechanization became the key driver of the UK industrial revolution, and it started to spread.
There was a lot of key pieces that came together.
Dorothy Neufeld is a writer with Vancouver's Visual Capitalist.
key pieces like the diffusion of knowledge, like postal and printing costs, which really allowed for information exchange to expand, which marks a contrast from the 15th century, where guilds and trade organizations really closely guarded this information. In 1790, the first patent law was created in the United States, and then later in 1791, the year after, in France. So inventors were protected, and this allowed for greater risk-taking and investment.
And by the 1850s, we've arrived at the second wave of innovation. Steel.
In the 1800s, that's when the new wave started. A number of new players came along based on the innovation of steel and the rail and the steam engines. And now the new wealth in this second wave of innovation became the trade based on those technologies.
We began to get iron and steel in far greater quantities than we had before, thanks to new processes. One of the things that's distinguishing about the second wave of industrialization is that we begin to get so many people working on these things, and they're sometimes one name like Henry Bessemer for steel will pop up. But even those people now tending to work with groups, they have enormous amount of support, a kind of a rudimentary form of what we would now call R&D, or research and development, and that began to inform the whole process. The whole system for marshaling capital and putting it to work in innovative ways is in place, whereas in earlier generations, they simply didn't have that much to work with. But by the end of the 19th century, not only do you have huge amounts of capital, but you also have a greater faith that this capital is going to pay off. By this time, the enormous possibilities of innovation and technology are widely apparent, and people know that that's, in fact, where the money is.
The wealthy investors saw opportunity and reached into their pockets.
The Rockefellers and the Carnegies of the world, all the robber barons, they out-competed the factory owners by controlling the trade. So they could squeeze the producer and take the margin when they transported it as a monopoly to a city where it could be sold for a much higher price. Now it was no longer the factory owners, it was the rail owners. And they became as huge as everybody knows from the names Morgan, Stanley, and Rockefellers until around 1900, when a new wave erupted.
The third wave began at the start of the 20th century, and with it, the name Henry Ford.
This third wave was based on the new technology called assembly line and driven by electricity and lights. This third wave is a wave of mass production. Henry Ford came up with the assembly line to make cars cheaper. He was able to provide cars to more or less any household in the US and also pay workers to have a proper demand side. And all the innovation around cars, electricity, and chemicals that came in enabled the mass production society, which we are still living in.
Now that's a good example of where the efficiency, if you will, of capital mobilization began to show its significance. Someone like Henry Ford, to pick an American example, simply would not have been able to function without the ability to marshal a great deal of capital to build gigantic factories that could use economies of scale to produce wealth.
The factories boomed and multiplied through the 1920s. Then the Great Depression hit, and no one was taking chances with new ideas. It took war to rekindle innovation and bring on the fourth wave. Mass communication.
And in the post-war age, a fourth wave came, and that was based on the transistor, the tiny little transistor that enabled much better communications with radio or TV, and of course, eventually computers, which enabled advanced aviation. now came the age of mass communication.
In the post-World War II period, if you had to look for an innovation that was central to what happened in the future, I would say that the creation of microelectronics, not only the transistor, but of course building on that into microcircuitry, integrated circuits, the chip. By the time you get to the early 1960s, we're beginning to use microcircuitry.
And it was in this Cold War period of the 1960s that the US government's spending in research and development peaked.
The US government, it actually created the first AI program in 1950, that then in 1960 developed the first AI chatbot. I think it can be easy to overlook how much of a role public research funding plays in early seeds of innovations, which take obviously decades even now to fully gain commercialization.
Electronics and its potential applications spawned simultaneous innovations across continents and cultures. But before we move on to wave five of this mostly Western story, we should note that innovation was happening elsewhere, but in different ways. Robert Friedel.
The Chinese, the Indians, the Arabs, all of the great cultures had their own periods of innovation, of contribution to science and the technology. But only in the West, in the last two or three centuries, have we gotten everything sort of coming together all at once. And then the enormous marshalling of the capacities for development and for innovation.
So, I mean, there is what's known as the Needham paradox, which is the fact that China developed a whole lot of key technologies, paper, gunpowders, printing, compasses, and many others, and yet China was not the central power behind the Industrial Revolution. So one of the questions that Joseph Needham asks is, why is it that Chinese innovation early on didn't translate into being the heart of the scientific revolution? And part of that has to do with the fact that Chinese innovation was developed to solve particular problems, that the institutions for disseminating ideas weren't as strong. And also there wasn't the degree of markets and competition that you saw in Europe.
But in the late 1970s, that all changed for China when it began its period of modernization and opening up.
To many Chinese, they saw science and technology as a way of national rejuvenation and national salvation, and it became a foundational principle of the modern Chinese state.
Advancing science and technology truly became a national obsession in 1978 with the rise of the then Chinese leader, Deng Xiaoping.
And then after reform and opening in the 1980s, China's innovation model was initially very catch-up oriented. China's was a system that went from a closed system to opening. So it was very much about learning, absorbing, scaling, taking advantage of globalization.
Lizzie Lee, fellow at the Asia Society Policy Institute's Center for China Analysis. But it takes China a decade or two to catch up, while the West still has the advantage.
In the 1980s, by 85, IBM, International Business Machines, became the world's biggest company. IBM was three times as big as Exxon, the second biggest company in the world's stock exchanges, through dominating the computer space, which was then mostly mainframes.
You're listening to Rear Vision on Radio National. I'm Ros Bluett, and today we're on an excursion through the six waves of innovation, from the 1750s until now. We've reached the disco years of the 1980s and are coming to the end of the fourth wave. Microchips are getting smaller. In fact, everything's getting smaller. And in the last decade of the 20th century, the fifth wave emerges.
During the 1990s, the internet erupted and also went into a frenzy. You can see that all of these five innovation waves has driven a new type of innovation starts in one place and they ripple out and they don't stop until they've more or less influenced the whole of society.
We got rid of floppy disks and stopped rebooting our computers. And the early 2000s saw us Googling and tweeting with cutting-edge software and smartphones.
So we've had a 250-year run of replacing human labor with machines to maximize labor productivity. And that's deeply institutionalized in the Western accounting and capitalist structure. We see that now happening again in what I would call the sixth wave of innovation, as we transition from these five waves that were all based on fossil fuels, coal, gas, and oil. Because now we're gradually moving out of the digital age with the internet and social media and mobiles into the solar age or the age of renewables and AI being the main defining technology.
And I think the classic example or emblem of this is with the smartphone, which contained all of these key components together. Maybe one of the first signals where you saw that it was reaching its peak point or inflection point is in 2019 when global smartphone sales hit a peak. Growth was being driven by higher prices instead of higher sales volumes or expansion into new markets. It's like, okay, we have 2019, and then maybe there was that natural transition period with AI coming to the fore.
And in this sixth wave of innovation, it seems that China has picked up speed and is ahead of the pack.
Solar power, wind power, drones, batteries, all fields where Chinese companies have taken the lead in innovation. How is China doing it? By copying others? Or are they finding their own innovation secret sauce? Could they even surpass the US as the world's leading innovator?
NVIDIA CEO was talking about how China, for example, has twice as much energy as the United States. And that energy is a critical part of the AI technology stack. Because unlike the previous wave, its computing is very energy intensive. Now in particular, because it's this sort of transition into this new AI-centered boom, it matters a lot because public funding will support unproven technologies that the private sector is unwilling to invest in. That funding in research really makes a huge difference in terms of the economic power of each nation. And I feel like China has a very thorough understanding of this, and that's why a lot of their scientific research is funded through a centralized public model that has these longer-term timeframes. But what's interesting also with China is a lot of the AI research and breakthroughs in particular have been funded by the private sector.
When it comes to pouring resources into innovation, China is very much determined to do that. But I would just point out one small nuance. If we look at the most stunning innovations, most striking advances coming from China, right, whether it's DeepSeek or Unitree's humanoid robotics, these are actually private companies. They are not state-owned enterprises directly supported by policy. For example, DeepSeek, right? DeepSeek is a tiny team with a fraction of the resources that American big tech spent. Or Unitree Robotics. Unitree now captured a dominant share of the global market with robots. And these are private sector successes, largely driven by innovative Chinese entrepreneurs. In fact, if you look at the SOEs, the state-owned enterprises that the Chinese government directly supported, they have been pretty disappointing when it comes to innovation outcome, right? China has something called the Big Fund, Big Fund 1.0. Big Fund 2.0. So those are semiconductor funding initiatives. There are lots of money flowed into state-owned enterprises. But there was not much progress in semiconductor. Lots of waste and corruption scandals. So I think the Communist Party, the party state, is slowly coming to recognition that when it comes to the agent of innovation, China needs its entrepreneurs. Money itself doesn't solve all the problems.
China has made innovation a national priority. Just over recent years, it's landed a craft on the dark side of the moon, it's deployed the world's largest sodium battery, built the world's largest high-speed rail network, developed a robot that can play piano, and opened a hotel where guests check in with facial recognition. So China is leading the world on areas such as driverless vehicles. Its national focus on innovation has become a core priority for the government.
And China's global technology metropolis of Shenzhen is a prime example.
To walk around Shenzhen is to see a tech hub which is very different from Silicon Valley's software startup culture. At the center of it all are the factories and the art of making. Makerspaces are everywhere where people produce, tinker, hack, and most famously, copy foreign tech.
A lot of developing countries got to be richer by copying and indeed stealing from advanced countries. That was the case when the United States was a major IP violator back in the 19th century, mostly from the United Kingdom.
China has built the most dense manufacturing ecosystems. It's not just how big the system is, it's also how clustered the manufacturing ecosystem is. So what do I mean by that? Well, researchers, suppliers, component makers, engineers, logistics networks, they are all very deeply integrated. So in many parts of China, the distance, the physical distance, and also the abstract distance between an idea and a factory floor is incredibly short. So if you want to build, say, a new hardware product, right, you can basically prototype, test, source components, and then scale production in weeks, not years.
The challenge of competing with China has caused people to reassess whether the market alone can create and mobilize the resources for innovation in the United States. And the belief, I think, is that it can't, especially when you're competing with a country where the government has been able to mobilize such vast sums of resources in the same areas.
However, Lizzie Lee says this is not just about money, but an education pipeline that China has been building for decades.
An engineering-heavy education pipeline. Now China produces enormous number of STEM graduates every year. A lot of them are in engineering fields. And now China has a labor force of more than 200 billion well-educated, technically trained, skilled workers.
And about Chinese STEM graduates, Robert Friedel has a student exchange moment that has stayed with him for over a decade.
May I tell you a little anecdote? Maybe 10 or 12 years ago, when relations were a little bit less frosty, Chinese in their 20s and 30s came to my university campus, and they would be given lectures, and we would try to talk about elements about American culture and the economy and the like. And I would talk about the American system of research and development. And I would absolutely struck the thing that stopped them cold was when I explained to them that in the American system, we thrived on failure. And they said, failure? You let people fail? I said, yes, the system won't work unless you let people fail. And there was such a cultural disconnect there in terms of understanding that you do not keep a safety net. The system doesn't work if you don't allow people to fail. You have to allow people the freedom to succeed, to beyond their wildest dreams, but you also have to allow the freedom to fail. That brought me up short, and it made me again think that these cultural differences, the differences in the world outlook of different societies, can color the way in which technologies work in these societies in ways that we don't always fully appreciate.
Lizzie Lee also sees this cultural difference in innovation.
We need to be clear about what China can do and what China cannot do. So we usually talk about 0 to 1 innovation versus 1 to 100 innovation. So 1 to 100 innovation is kind of taking an existing innovation and accelerating it through a scale. This is where China is doing extraordinarily well. But 0 to 1 is something different. You know, that's the kind of breakthrough discovery that comes from very open-ended research environment, experimentation, and also the institutional tolerance for failure and uncertainty. And China is much less consistently strong there. I mean, it has certainly moved forward on foundational innovation, but it's not quite there yet. It's not because Chinese scientists lack creativity. I think it's because the incentives of the system is fundamentally different. You know, the system rewards scaling, rewards immeasurable output and industrial targets. So I think that's what's fundamentally shaping China's innovation.
So what are the key skills needed today to innovate? And is China holding all the cards?
Each country has its own strengths and weaknesses. Collaboration, that's the ideal world. Scientific collaboration is still very much needed in a lot of critical fields. For example, biotech, AI safety. Those are areas that I think are critical for humanity, not just for China or United States or bilateral relationships. If we do not handle this tension between competition and collaboration well, my fear is that a lot of those collaboration areas that are so critical will suffer.
China, I think they see this picture very clearly, and they are investing exactly the amount of money in a strategic direction. They are shaping their production capacity, so they will be the dominant electrostate in the world in the coming decades. And they will have enough production capacity, just as the UK had enough production capacity to more or less close the whole world in the late 1700s. China now has enough production capacity to supply the electrotech revolution products to the whole world. In the first 250 years, the scarcity was good machines, labor, capital to invest in those. Now there's an abundance of capital and machines and people, but our living planet is becoming the scarce commodity. And that means innovations from solar, wind, battery, heat pumps, new ways of doing agriculture, vertical farming, recycling of metals, the circular innovations, all those make for a resource productivity revolution. And as we go towards 2050, the companies that can navigate and dominate that new value creation logic, shifting from a linear fossil to a circular renewable economy, they will become the world's biggest companies by 2040 or 2050. That's the current wave we're in the midst of.
Per Espen Stoknes, Associate Professor and Co-Director of the BI Centre for Sustainability and Energy in Oslo, ending today's program. You also heard from Robert Friedel, Professor Emeritus in the Department of History at the University of Maryland, Lizzie Lee from Asia Society Policy Institute's Centre for China Analysis in Washington, D.C., Andrew Lee, author of The Shortest History of Innovation, and Dorothy Neufeld, writer for Visual Capitalist in Vancouver. Today's sound engineer was Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. I'm Ros Bluett, and you've been listening to Rear Vision. Thanks for your company.